I have the exams. I haven't graded them. I looked at them, though. I know that you found it. You guys found it difficult. I can see that.
As long as you see that.
I can see that. Yes. So this is yet another homework being distributed back. And then this is the stubborn homework that's never being picked up. I tried again and again. Okay, so I don't have the exam. Probably I'll have them ready by Monday. But I want to go over the problem number 2 and 3 today because it will help the learning process. Now, I don't believe that those problems were difficult. It's just too new for you guys. Summer's learning pace, you know, it's just too fast. You didn't have, students usually don't get the digestion time so readily available in the summer. That's why I find it not an optimal thing to do a summer course, but for various reasons you guys had to do it, so we are trying our best. Okay, and if there is not enough digestion time, we can create some digestion time by going over the problems. And hopefully, at the end, you'll learn anyways. Okay, so the solutions are already over there. Over there meaning in the cloud or whatever, internet. You can look at all of them, but I'm just going to go over 2 and 3. I also posted a homework that's due tomorrow, okay? And we'll make some progress, and then we'll see whether you can actually turn it in tomorrow at 5. I think you can. So this question, you know, if you just follow step by step what I was asking, it really wasn't a hard problem, but it sort of like depends on you understanding things appropriately. All right, so it all starts with an incident electromagnetic wave that's propagating in z direction, and it hits the boundary of a copper block at z equals 0. Okay, what happens? It can't quite penetrate into the copper, it gets reflected, okay? But it penetrates a little bit because copper is not a perfect conductor, but a damn good conductor, let's put it that way, okay? And in solving this problem, you can play this game once in a while, treating copper as a PEC, and once in a while, you take into account that it's not a PEC. This is what I was trying to sort of like lead you through step by step, okay? So the first question says, given that we have this incident field, EI, that's polarized in X direction, what is the reflected electric field? And I say specifically, for this calculation, pretend that this copper block is actually a PEC. If it's a PEC, there's going to be zero electric field inside. Therefore, everything that is incident has to be coming back out with the same amplitude, such that the tangential electric field at the surface is equal to zero. So then you basically copy EI, except that you flip around two signs. Which two signs? Well, first of all, you put a negative number so that when EI plus ER is added, when they are added, they cancel out, they go to zero. And you flip one more sign, that is in the cosine argument, because the ER is propagating in the opposite direction. Yes?
I switched that to phasor form. Is that
don't worry about that, you'll get partial credit. But if I ask, if I ask phasor, give phasor. If I don't ask phasor, give the other one, okay? I mean, follow the rules, all right? I don't know, maybe I'll be merciful and won't take any points, but depends. Depends how you presented it. If you were super neat and clean and made a presentable presentation, then I will be, my sympathies will be with you. If it's all messy, you know, then there is less sympathy. And grading is not an easy thing. Grading is the worst part of teaching, okay? And we all hate grading in some sense. Because you end up spending all your time with the garbage rather than the good stuff. Good stuff you check. Anyway, so try to present your problems in a nice way and you will always benefit from it. Professors will always have sympathize with you. Okay, so part A was good. Now, part A is of course an approximation. Okay? Instead of pretending this thing was a PEC, you could have actually done this correctly. To do it correctly, you would have to go eta 2 minus eta 1 divided by eta 2 plus eta 1 and multiply that with EI and then adjust some signs. That's all. In fact, what would have been the reflection coefficient? What would you have found? Right now, I am effectively saying my reflection coefficient is minus 1. That is where that sign negation is coming from. But what if we follow the formula? Would we have had minus 1? What would we have had? We would have had a complex number that would be extremely close to minus 1. Okay? On the complex plane, minus 1 sits right here. This is where minus 1 is sitting. I would have ended up something that is somewhere here. I don't know. I didn't do the calculation. And to the extent that it is so close to minus 1, when I add the incident and the reflected fields together, I would have almost zero tangential electric field. Okay? And that almost zero tangential electric field would have to be also present in the other side, because tangential electric field is continuous. Okay? Okay. And I would have a tremendously small electric field on the other side because my reflection coefficient would be almost minus 1, and then 1 plus almost minus 1 is almost 0. And I would have that on the other side. Okay, I chose not to do that. Instead, I chose to proceed as it was instructed, and some of you guys follow. Part B asked for, what is the total H at Z equals 0? Hint, use EI and ER from above to deduce this. So what am I going to do? I'm going to translate each of my incident and reflected fields, electric fields, of which the reflected electric field is an approximation, but I'm crossing my fingers that it's a good approximation. If it is a good approximation, it will give me a good HR approximation as well. And I will add my H incident, which is exact, and my H sub R, which is approximate, but good approximate. I will have a good total tangential H that is a good approximation. Now, what will I do with that? Well, if I were to insist that we don't have a copper, but we have a PEC, I would take that tangential electric field and attribute to the surface current. If, on the other hand, as I indicate in part C in the hint, I remember that sigma is finite, I would say that H sub tangential H from one side is the same as the tangential H from the other side, and therefore I continue and enter the second medium. Now, in the second medium, that H is going to quickly drop, very quickly drop, all the way almost to zero. So this is why sometimes we just don't worry about that finite value that is quickly dropping to zero. Choose to ignore all of it and say inside the copper, which we are pretending to be a PEC, there is no H field. Okay? But in fact, there is. It just drops very rapidly. It's a choice on our part. So these are things that I have talked over the last few weeks in various occasions, and I know that some of you were paying attention, others were paying less attention. Hopefully, at this point, you are paying all the attention because now you suffered through this problem, okay? By going through this problem, now you're trying to sort of like clear out any misconceptions or confusions that you have. Any questions how I am proceeding with this problem, okay? So, basically, my HI is very easy to figure out. I do some right-hand rule stuff. Since I have my E's, all I'm going to do is I'm going to divide my E's. I'm still on the air side, so I'm going to divide those by 120 pi's and then adjust the directions. Okay? My incident electric field was x-polarized, and the wave was propagating in z-direction, so that requires a y-directed H. Okay? So I will take this E sub I, divide it by 125, and change its unit vector from x to y. Now, this guy, okay, is going in the opposite direction, and it too has to generate a wave, this time traveling in the opposite direction. So I see that my E cross H is going to be giving the right propagation direction away from the surface if the H is again in y direction. The H's are both in y direction. They don't cancel, they add. Okay? The second one, the reflected one, is an approximation, is a damn good approximation. So I'm going to just add them. So it amounts to doubling the H of the incident field. That's all it does. Right, Jason? Okay. and that's, let's look at how I did that. I say, okay, HI is 24 divided by 120 pi times cosine omega t minus bz, beta z in y direction. HR is effectively the same thing, even also in y direction, but I have a plus sign. But then I evaluate the sum of these two things at z equals to 0, so plus minus differences don't matter. The answer is 48 divided by 120 pi cosine omega t. That's the right answer. That's almost the right answer. I know that maybe a tiny bit is not right, but I don't care at this point. Any questions? Okay, so now, in part C, we are asking for the transmitted magnetic field phasor. So it's time to go from this into the phasor land. And I just forget about the cosine omega t, and this becomes a phasor. Correct? And that phasor is what I copy here, because the tangential electric H field is going to be continuous across the surface. Tangential H is always continuous across all realistic surfaces. It's only in the case of unrealistic surface of a PEC we put a J sub S. Alright, so that now we have our H sub T. So if you were with me or with us until this point, chances are maybe you did something reasonable at the next step. In the next step, we are saying what is the accompanying E sub T? Okay? Once you do this calculation, you should almost get zero, but not quite zero. Okay, so what are you going to do? You're going to take your H amplitude, multiply it with the eta, and then change around directions once again by 90 degrees. A y-directed magnetic field is going to demand an x-directed electric field, okay? But that's, I have this eta 2, okay? So 48, this eta 2 is not 120 pi. It's not canceling this guy. That eta 2 is a tiny number. This is where my hint comes in again. My hint was, use the amplitude and phase of complex eta for good conductor case. Okay? This is where you either derive that eta, which is what I always do because I always forget, or you look up the table. And I always know how to derive it because I always replace basically my epsilon by epsilon plus sigma over j omega, and then forget about epsilon. That gives me that equation. Okay? I don't need to go to my cheat sheet. Okay? I sort of like think about the influences of the parameters. So my 48 over 120 pi stays here, but this is a tiny number because sigma is sitting on the bottom. That sigma is a huge number, it's 10 to the 8 or something like that. It makes this entire thing very small, okay? Ultimately, okay, there are some complications here, okay? But they are not unheard of. You sort of dealt with them in some of the homework problems. First of all, there is a square root of j. Square root of j is 1 at an angle of 45 degrees, okay? So then I write this thing as 48 over 120 pi, just the magnitude, omega mu over sigma square root, e to the j pi over 4. And that actually becomes needed if you are going to get the exact right result at the end. All right? And then when I plug in numbers, I get 3.6 times 10 to the minus 4, okay? So that, when it multiplies this thing, fries that thing into a tiny electric field. There's a tiny electric field. Okay. Now, had you done the full calculation from step one, okay, you could have gotten even a better result than mine. But it would not have been worth your effort, because the difference would have been so small. All this because sigma is so large. Okay. Any questions?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What if I use transmission coefficient?
What if you use the transmission coefficient? Your reflection coefficient is almost minus 1. Yeah, of course, you use the transmission coefficient. Because you have almost minus 1, and you add 1 to almost minus 1, okay, you have a tiny transmission coefficient. And then, that if you did it right, you're going to get the right result. In other words, if in part A, if you ignored my advice, you use your calculator to calculate the exact reflection coefficient for that surface, taking into account eta 2, which is a complex number, but very small complex number, right? It's almost as short. Okay, this is why the reflection coefficient is almost minus 1. All right, what is the reflection coefficient formula? Reflection coefficient formula is eta 2 minus eta 1, which is eta 0, divided by eta 2 plus eta 0. Okay, this number, if you plug in numbers, is tiny, okay, very close to 0, so therefore it is almost minus 1. All right, but maybe you did this calculate this. Suppose you did it. Is this what you did?
Yeah.
Okay, good. Suppose you did it, and then you add 1 to it to get the transmission coefficient. Okay? Now you're adding 1 to almost minus 1, so you're going to end up with a transmission coefficient that is tiny. And then you take that and multiply with the electric field, you're going to get the right result.
So the eta 2 should be the
No, from now on, okay, once your coefficients become complex, okay, you cannot wish for the best and ignore its angle. You have to keep going. Okay? All right. But, you know, I don't know what number you're going to get. I don't know what the angle of it is going to be. It's going to be such a tiny transmission coefficient, okay? It's going to be so close to the origin. I don't know what its angle is going to be. Hopefully you did everything right. Or did you? I don't know. We'll see. All right? But why didn't you follow my advice? I said, how many people followed my advice? I think some number did. Okay. Good for you. All right. So now, let us continue, though. Lee, that was a fine question. And it gave us a complex quantity here. Okay? The complex quantity, a tiny electric field, okay, it worked out to be 4.69 times 10 to the minus 5 times at an angle e to the j 45 degrees volts per meter. That's my electric field. You see that it's tiny, yeah.
Is that t or plus?
Which one?
Plus,
it's a plus. You know why it's plus? Because by mistake I made it minus. And then I say, hey, why did I put a minus? I have to correct it. Instead of an eraser, I turn minus into plus. That's why it's plus. But sometimes it's good to put the plus, just to, you know, emphasize. Yes?
What if I turn the each of the j pi over 4 into a coordinate?
You mean rectangular?
Yeah.
I will follow and see whether you did things right, okay? In other words, if you did that right, you know, you're fine. However, you know, choosing whether you use rectangular or exponential form of complex numbers is always an important decision to make your calculation easier or harder. Typically, when you are adding things, you want to do that in rectangular form. Whereas when you are multiplying or dividing things, you are usually better off with the exponential form. Okay? Anyways, but maybe you did it right, that's fine. Okay? Any questions now? So I have a tiny electric field. It's not zero. If it were zero, there would be, of course, nothing to calculate. Some of you guys said it is zero because you gave up. You realized it was very small, but you didn't have the stamina to deal with it, and you said it's zero. At the end, you say reflection. The resistance is also equal to zero, some of you did. Okay. Anyway, I will evaluate things partial credit-wise. Any questions now? I'm almost down. I have an electric field. I have an H field. I can cross-multiply them. I can get my pointing flux. That is part E. Okay, so look at this. 1/2 the real part of EH conjugate, cross multiplication. Cross multiplication is dealing with X and Y, so that's fine. That gives a Z-directed unit vector. That's no big deal. Now, E and H have the same magnitude except that one of them has eta in it. Okay, so that 24 divided 120 pi gets squared and pulls out. Okay, I still have to deal with the that tiny little square root for the magnitude times e to the j pi over 2. Now, that e to the j pi over 2, now I can sort of say, hey, Euler's, that is cosine of 45 degrees plus j sine of 45 degrees. But taking the real part, the j sine doesn't contribute, and cosine of 45 degrees is j sine, 1 over square root of 2. Okay, so that's how that calculation goes, just as you see over there, right?
Wait, quick question.
Yeah. And then I can stick that square root of 2 inside the omega mu over sigma, and since omega is 2 pi f, I can get rid of 2s and get pi f mu divided by sigma. Yes. That's what you're going to ask. Okay, so then I'm sort of like, that's my answer, okay? I'm presenting my answer as 1/2 and then 45 divided by 120 pi squared, and that's this tiny little number. I don't bother multiplying that through, and I will be permissive how you did it. If I multiply everything through, then you lose sight of what is contributing what. It's good to sometimes to see what is coming from where. So that's why I multiply that. Any questions? Are we ready for the last part? Okay, the last part says that, okay, fine, now you've gotten your watts per meter squared that this copper is absorbing. It's a tiny amount of watts per meter squared because most of the incident power is being reflected. Yet there is a little bit of a loss. This loss will have an effect in cavities, in lossy transmission lines, etc., when you care about calculating these things. Okay, so we have sort of like educated ourselves for that eventuality. When we really need to calculate losses, this is how losses are calculated. However, we had to go and do some cumbersome stuff. We had to, for instance, estimate the size of a tiny electric field. We could have bypassed all that, okay? How could we have bypassed all that? Well, we could have said that H on the surface is not going into the medium as the same H. Rather, it is going to zero, okay? And it is being compensated by J sub S. Okay, and then maybe by squaring that J sub S and multiplying with the right factor, we're going to get the same number. If we develop such a strategy, we can use that strategy over and over and over again. It is indeed that H goes into the copper, but very quickly goes to zero. It really makes sense, instead of going through what we are going through here, to set, okay, the H inside to zero and pretend it is compensated by J sub S. All right, so I'm going to now follow my instructions. What are the instructions? The surface determine surface resistance such that time average E cross H is equal to 1/2 R sub S J sub S square. That 1/2 J sub S, R sub S J sub S square is very reminiscent of 1/2 R I square that you guys are used to from your circuit courses. You are defining by declaring this and equating to E cross H this to be, you are defining the radiation surface resistance in this way, okay? And of course, surface resistance we had calculated in an example earlier. And some of you guys had the formula and used that formula and got the same right result, actually, in this. But now, we're going to get the right result here by taking my E cross H. I copy it here. And I say that is equal to 1/2 R sub S times J sub S squared. But what is J sub S squared? It's the same as H squared. So I put the H squared term here. This cancels this guy. 1/2 cancels this guy. My R sub S becomes pi F mu over sigma. That's exactly the formula that we had earlier. That's the surface resistance. You plug in the numbers, and a lot of you did actually, a few of you who used the formula, can come up with the number, 2.6 times 10 to the minus 4 ohms. Tiny. It's almost zero. But in some sense, it is almost zero. Of course, almost zero itself is a meaningless thing, you know. When you say something is almost zero, you have to compare it to something else. I say it is almost zero when this resistance is calculated, is compared to other resistances that are applying in this calculation, the most important being perhaps 8 and 9. That's 125. That's 377 ohms versus something like 10 to the minus 4. There's a million difference between them. So this is tiny in that sense. But it's not zero, okay? Any questions? So was this hard? It was hard. But why was it hard? Because you were not perhaps ready for it. You had not digested it. After this session, you guys are with me? In the future, will you notice? Is this not a neat trick? This is the perturbation theory. This is just doing the right approximation when you can. Idealizations, you go back and forth between real life and the ideal life. Pattern and doctored so that it helps you with the real life situations. Okay, this problem. Now, again, you know, students like bounce diagrams, but maybe works out better during the semester when you have extra buffer days to digest all this stuff, okay? And so let's look at the circuit first. Okay, so I put the described source and the load. Load is 25 ohms. This is 50 ohm line, another 50 ohm line. There is a 25 ohm in series there. And the source is some signal, which can be a delta or U of T, whatever we like later on, in series with a 50 ohm. Okay? So first part of the problem is calculate all the coefficients, all injection, reflection, transmission coefficients that you're going to need. As soon as you start drawing a bounce diagram just like this, you're going to need all those coefficients, okay? I gave them reasonable names, and nobody asked me about the names. So you were all okay with the nomenclature, even though we didn't carefully define those, okay? All right, and they are quite straightforward. First is the injection coefficient, 50 ohm, 50 ohm, half the voltage is going to be put into the first line. So the first coefficient is 1/2. That is why I have 1/2 going on the first line. Okay? And then there is a reflection coefficient, which is going to take into account series combination of 25 ohms and 50 ohms. That is why I have 75 minus 50 divided by 75 plus 50, giving me 1/5. Okay? So then you would say I would add 1 to it and get my transmission coefficient, but that is not correct in this case. Indeed, you add 1 to it, okay? That becomes 6/5, but then you have to multiply that with a voltage division factor that takes into account 25 on the division between 25 volts and 50 volts, okay? And that really requires a multiplication with 50 divided by 75, okay? When you do all that, you get 4/5. A lot of people got these things right, okay? I think majority did remember that detail. Okay, then you're going back, and in going back, some people elegantly said that what I calculated here are going to be by symmetry the same numbers. Other people just calculated it true, but a lot of you saw the symmetry, no problem. And then, important thing, the reflection coefficient at the generator end is equal to zero because the impedances are meshed. That simplifies the bounce diagram. Anything that is coming back to the generator is not going to reflect again. Okay? And the load reflection coefficient that we forgot somewhere is -1. Okay? So with all this, then I play the ping pong game. Okay, only 4 microseconds is requested. Transition across each of those segments takes 1 microsecond. So going all the way from the source through the resistor all the way to the final load, it should take 2 microseconds. And then coming back another 2 microseconds. So 4 microseconds is actually the longest bounce that is possible in this system. And there are some shorter bounces. There is a shorter bounce here. Okay? And then, but that doesn't bounce anymore because reflection coefficient at the generator end is equal to zero. Yes, Brian.
Why is your 1/2 microsecond?
Just a moment. That is the crux. This is to answer your question is why I'm going through this. Okay? Because I realize a lot of students could start the problem but could not quite then interpret it. Okay? I'm going to get there. Okay? But first, just calculating the numbers. Are you good calculating the numbers? Basically, most of you are good with that. You keep sequentially multiplying them. Nothing happens here. But this guy comes back. There is a reversal of sign because our reflection coefficient is negative. Okay? And then there is a further injection and further reflection. You have to have the right number here, otherwise you're going to lose 1 point. But this doesn't come into the picture in the rest of the problem. But these do, okay? Because the next part says, give me the impulse response, voltage impulse response at 150 meters, okay? So it is at that point, Brian, I go to my bounce diagram and think of a vertical line that is going from top to bottom, right at the center at 150 meters. And I see where I have crossings of that vertical line with the slanted lines, which are the trajectories of my flying impulses. Okay? One of them happens at 1/2, the other happens at 1.5, and the last one happens at 3.5. So I'm going to have 3 impulses at 1/2, 1.5, and 3.5. And I just copy those. I place them, and I put the numbers next to them. Okay? This is the technique. This is technique that works really easily after you have seen it and digested it. Now, digestion is taking place right now for Brian and a lot of people. Any questions? So, I promise you that there will be a bounce diagram problem in the final exam. Complexity no more, no less than this. Just something of this order. And I want everybody to get it all right. Okay? So now, of course, had I asked for the impulse response at some other location, these deltas would have been at other places, okay? And in fact, if I was looking for something very close to this junction, these two deltas would have sort of emerged and even sit on top of one another if I were asking it exactly at 300 meters, which is sort of like confusing. It is confusing until you, in your mind, separate them out a little bit and look at it in a limiting sense, and then you erase your confusion that way. Okay?
It would be a different result if you were talking about just on the left side.
Of course, then that would be, because we do have that series thing, exactly. You have now discontinuity in that sense. Okay, so But this is what it was, and I have 1/2, 1/10 minus 8 over 75. Now, minus 8 over 75 is not all that different from 1/10, if you think about it. They are just about the same size. Any questions? So, now, some students at this point diligently wrote this function. They say that 1/2 delta of t minus half plus 1/10 plus 1/10 times delta of t minus 1/2 and the final term. That was good. I didn't ask for it, but that is good. Because then they replace that deltas in that expression with u of t's. Now they have 1/2 u of t minus half plus 1/10 u of t minus 1/2. Now they have the explicit function they need to graph in the last part. And I did all that in my mind, but I didn't put it here. Okay, a lot of you guys did it in your minds too. There were a lot of correct answers to this, but there were a lot of incorrect answers too. And the second group is why we are going through this. Okay, and then, and see, every time there is a delta, something happens in the real graph. It is zero, it jumps to 1/2. At 1/2, I jump from 1/2 to 1/2 plus 1/10. Then it undoes it, and then I don't know what happens because we didn't care, we didn't ask. Increasingly smaller changes will be taking place. Any questions? And this is on the first line. Okay? We come to the very last part of the problem, which is as t goes to infinity, what happens to the voltage at the load end? And it is a quartus, because everything, you know, goes to DC, and then 1 volt of u of t as t goes to infinity has to be shared between all the explicit resistances that are present in the circuit. That's the source resistance, the resistance in between the two lines, and the load resistance. The transmission lines themselves just poofed away. They just like went into clear air. They don't play a role. So then you have 1 going over 50, which is the source resistance. So half of that 1 is in the source. And then the remaining half is each of them quarter volts appearing across the other 25 resistors. Any questions? So that's it. So look at the solutions, and I think a few students who after the exam realized how easy it was to draw this vertical line and then take advantage of the crossings at 1/2, 1/2, and 3/2, they realized at that point the lamp turned on their brains. I didn't know it was so easy. Because they were instead going to those formulas in the formula sheet, right? So they have written on those summation things. At the time I said, these are terrible equations. You know, let's not depend on them. Let's depend on a procedure. Okay. All right, so that's a review of the exam. Let's move on. Where are we now? We are at this point. So we talked about resonators. We realized that a transmission line section, which we call a stub, that is either left open circuited at the load end or short circuited at the load end, is going to appear at the input end either as an open or a short, depending its length at the given frequency. Okay? These open or short behaviors occur when the actual length of the transmission line happens to be some integer multiple of lambda over 4. Okay? And the details of that statement depends whether the behavior is open or short. But then we say, what about at other lengths? What about at other frequencies? What is the input impedance? There should be an input impedance function that depends on either the length or the frequency, depending how you want to portray the problem. That should be compatible with the zeros and infinities that occur periodically at chosen frequencies that we call the resonant frequencies, for which we have formulae. And also, it should be part of a function that is purely imaginary, because this system is dissipation-free. There is no resistance in it. Therefore, impedance-wise, it's purely reactive. Okay? So that's what we are after. And we were then trying to get that result. To get that result, we took our D'Alembert solution, turned them into phasors. Okay? Now we're going up, talking about e to the b plus or b minus multiplied with e to the minus j beta z or e to the plus j beta z. And then we decided to change our coordinate system and call e to the minus beta z to be e to the plus beta d. D is running opposite to z, and d equals 0 is our load location. That's the criterion that we are selecting. or the notation. And here is the voltage expression, for instance. This represents a forward-going wave. By this time, it may be confusing what is forward, what is backwards. But by this time, when I say forward, I mean wave that is going from the generator towards the load. That's what forward means. Backward means everything was not absorbed in the load. Something has been sent back, which is not a good thing. We will learn how to deal with it later on. But that's what the situation is. So the bad guy is here. This is the bad guy. This is the backward going wave. Okay? The bad guy, of course, has a minus sign if you turn the bad guy into a current. So negativity and badness go hand in hand. Maybe this is a way of memorizing or learning, remembering these things. That's the current, okay? And this is as a function of D. And this D is measured from the load. And D, you can think of D as a dynamic variable. D can be 0, 1, 2, 3, or D could be 0, 1/10 of a wavelength, 20% of a wavelength, etc. You can think of D like a continuous variable on the line, or you can think of D as the actual length of the line. Although for that, we will sometimes use L, okay? So, but think about this in a flexible way, that either way of thinking about this is good, okay? That's my recommendation. All right, V of D and I of D are the voltage and phasor currents. Voltage and current phasors. We take their ratio. Voltage to current ratios in phasor domain are our impedances. This is our definition of impedance, so we do that. Okay? And we make one simplification in this case. We are not doing the most general derivation yet. The most general derivation is going to come tomorrow or something like that, or Monday. Right now, we are doing this for a short circuit ended transmission line of length L, and that means that there is a certain constraint here. What is that constraint? Voltage cannot be anything but zero at a short. So we take our voltage waveform, the expression for voltage, and set it to equal to zero at D equals zero. So this is the convenience of setting the load to be D equal to zero. All right. And what does that give us? That gives us this relationship. V minus is the negative of V plus. Okay, this is in harmony with a reflection coefficient of minus 1 that works out when you use it for a short. Okay, so then my V sub D and I sub D equations are as given. Okay, what used to be plus has become a minus because I factor out the common V plus here. And what used to be a minus has become a plus because I have factored out V plus, and my division by Z0 should not be forgotten. Okay, those are my phasor forms, phasors of total voltage and total current. But using that sine-cosine relations with Euler's identity, I recognize this guy to be related to sine beta d, right? That's clear cut. I just divide this by 2j and multiply it by 2j, and then that exponential minus its conjugate divided by 2j is sine beta d, okay? For the current case, I have a cosine beta d. Okay? And sometimes I will take z0 and invert it and call it y0. Okay? So this thing of impedance as well as admittance is very useful. When we combine things in series, impedances add. When we combine things in parallel, impedances don't add. They do funny things. You have to invert them, add them, invert them again. Instead of that, when you combine things in parallel, it is more convenient to work in terms of the inverses of impedances, which are admittances, okay? So when we go to the Smith chart, starting maybe next lecture, using the Smith chart as a tool to transform impedances and admittances is going to play a big role. And a lot of times we'll work with admittances rather than impedances, because when you have a transmission line and you put add elements that is spanning from one wire to the other wire, those are shunt connections. They are parallel in essence rather than series. So it makes sense to work with admittances a lot. Okay, so we will, in 210, most of the time we work with impedances. Very rarely we go into admittances. There is very good reasons in doing this stuff in going to admittances, and we'll be doing that soon. Okay, so Y0, which is the inverse of Z0, is characteristic admittance. Any questions? And now, I of course interpret these guys as standing waves. I have several times talked about standing waves. St- standing waves. This is the sine cos cos thing that I talked about the other day. We have lost time domain because we went into the in the phasor domain, you know, and then therefore we only have sine and cosines only in terms of the space variable beta d. But then one of them is purely imaginary, the other is not, and that is that purely imaginary is a telltale sign that if I went into the time domain, I would acquire a sine there. Okay, so J is a reminder that there was a sine time function there. Any questions? Anyway, so I'm talking too much. It's time to divide that. That becomes our impedance. So I divide these two expressions. Okay, and J remains. 2B pluses cancel out. It's sort of a neat expression. J times, J is needed. We knew that this was going to be all reactive, so J is needed. Just like in J omega L or 1 over J omega C for the inductor or capacitor, we got a purely reactive impedance. And then, of course, its unit has to be impedance unit, so Z0 has to show up there. Okay. When I divide the I in the bottom, that Y0, 1 over Y0 gives us back the Z0. And then tangent of theta L. So impedance in general is zero real part plus just J times X, and X is the reactance. If I plot that reactance, is that if I plot that as a function of what? I can plot it as a function of distance for a given frequency. What is beta? Brian, what is beta? Beta is omega divided by? No. Beta is omega divided by C or B. That's beta. Okay? So in that tangent function that you see here, therefore, there is a beta, there is an omega, and there is an L, okay? You can do plots fixing some of these and think of in terms of the other variable, okay? In other words, you can fix L to be so many meters, and then you can vary beta or omega, which are proportional to one another, and draw a function that is tangent function going through zeros and infinities. And if you think of it as a function of omega, as each time you go through the zeros and infinities, you are going through those series and parallel resonances that we talked about last lecture, okay? And in between those points where you go through zeros and infinities, you are getting all the other reactive, all the reactive impedances. Time to look at a plot like this. Here is a plot like that. In this case, I did not plot it as a function of frequency. Instead, I plot it as a function of, if you wish, L. Okay? I fix my frequency. That fixes beta. And then I fix my L. L equals 0 gets me right here. And L equal to 0, this quantity is 0.
Yeah.
Okay? That is because you are at the short. Remember what we are looking at. What we are looking at is this. We have a stub of some length L, and that is the L that shows up over there. We have terminated its load end with a short. We are looking into there, and we are saying that there is an impedance Z of L. And that impedance Z of L has zero real part. It's a pure J times X of L. That X of L is that function that is being plotted. Okay? Actually, X of L is Z0 times the function that is being plotted. Right. You with me? Okay, so at L equal to 0, this line has shrunk into nothingness. You are at the short and your impedance is 0. But then, as L is increasing, then you are following this curve. Now, you go from 0 to positive. Positive reactance, is it inductive or is it capacitive? Huh? Right? Or you? No. It's inductive. The analogy here is this, okay? Z is for an inductor J omega L. Therefore, the reactance of inductor is positive, okay? But Z is 1 over J omega C for a capacitor, which you can write like this, negative J times 1 over omega C. This is the reactance, including the minus sign in front of it. Therefore, capacitors have negative reactances. So you look at the sign of your reactance. If it is positive, you behave inductively. If the sign is negative, you behave capacitively. you resemble a capacitor. Now, why would we be? So, if you follow this curve all the way to the end, you go through an inductive phase, but then there is an asymptote. You go one through one of these resonances, okay, where the impedance goes to infinity. Impedance going to infinity is which behavior? Open behavior or short behavior?
Open
behavior. Impedance going to infinity is open behavior. And open behavior, is it series behavior or parallel behavior as far as LC circuits are concerned? It's the parallel, okay? That's a parallel resonance. Here we go. We go through a parallel resonance here, series resonance here, parallel resonance here, etc., etc. Okay, so this is the way to read this graph. And we start inductively, we go through a resonance, we come on the other side. On the other side, our reactance is negative. Therefore, we are?
Capacitive.
Now, how much distance is this distance actually? Brian, do you have a guess? Well, let's figure out. That is beta L is equal to, what is it?
2 pi over.
It is pi over 2. What is this beta? 2 pi over? Beta is 2 pi over?
Lambda,
exactly. Okay, so now, in this equation, we can cancel out these guys and these guys. Lambda will go to the top. This 2 will come to the bottom. What am I getting? L equals? Lambda over? Yes. Okay, so we have, evidently, our impedance function varies in which a lambda over 4 variation is an important variation. Okay? But lambda over 2 variation, which happens the next time, is even more important because this is the period. Okay? When I go from here to here, I perform my full, one cycle of my full periodic variation. So impedances, therefore, at the input, experience all possible impedances that can be obtained when I move away from the load by a distance of lambda over 2. Okay? Impedance function, in the sense that we have defined, okay, Z, just let me just say Z, which is R plus JX. This is going to be on transmissions line periodic, and its periodicity is lambda over 2. Okay, every time your line length increases by lambda over 2, you get back where you are. Okay? And here, we are lambda over 4 away. Now, this was a short. Impedance is 0. That's a telltale sign that we are at a short. A quarter wave away from it, our impedance is infinity. That's a telltale sign that we are at a? What is the opposite of short?
Open.
Okay, so shorts and opens are separated by a distance of lambda over 4. Lambda over 4 separates adjacent shorts and opens. Okay? But lambda over 2s are always transitions from short to short and open to open. Any questions? Okay, so inductive, then capacitive, inductive, capacitive, I go like that. Now, the fact that if I have a very short transmission line, which is terminated by a short. This picture, let's make it like this. This is very short.
Okay.
So this length is now much, much less than lambda over 4. The fact that this is an inductor should not come as a surprise to you guys. This is what our first inductor, coax inductor, that for which we calculated the inductance was just like that, right? We took a coax and put a short on one end, and we calculate the corresponding inductance. That's what we have recovered. Okay? But for an inductor, inductor's VI relations is J omega L, okay? And that implies a linear relationship between the inductance and the frequency. We see that linear relationship right here. If we look at here, the curve is linear. But if we continue further, the curve becomes nonlinear. Okay, so basically we have to say that a coax that has been short-circuited at one end, and if it is very short compared to lambda, even short compared to lambda over 4, behaves exactly like an inductor. But then, as you start making it longer and longer, and the length start getting closer and closer to lambda over 4, it is no longer an inductor. It is still inductive because its sign is positive, but it's more complicated. Okay? Then it goes through a complication crisis right at lambda over 4. And it emerges on the other side, still complicated, but capacitor-like. But then you make it longer and longer and longer and bring it closer and closer to lambda over 2 lambda, it starts behaving just like a capacitor would be. It has a linear relationship with respect to omega. So in this discussion, I am relying on the fact that omega and beta are linearly related. Because omega and beta are linearly related, even though this is a beta function, I could say what I did say. All right? Any questions here? All right, so appreciate this result. I have a lot of discussions here. This is interesting. JZ0 tan beta L. If beta L is very small, one of those approximations allows me to replace tan beta L with just beta L, okay? Cosine of a very small angle is 1, almost. Or at the next level, it is 1 minus angle squared divided by 2 if you use the angle in radian. But for sine, small parameter, what is sine theta? For theta, very small.
0.
Yes, exactly, it's 0, but...
Oh.
Yeah, so the approximation I'm after is that sine of theta is approximately theta. Okay, this is the first term of its series expansion. Of course, at 0 is exactly 0, but you know, if you're talking about the sine of 0.001 radian, I don't have to go to a calculator. It's 0.001 for all practical purposes. Okay? Now, cosine of theta is 1 minus theta squared over 2. Okay? So this is, of course, at a higher accuracy level than this. Okay? If you don't want to go second order, cosine theta is 1 for very small theta. And when you take their ratio, you have 10, okay? Tan theta is sine theta over cosine theta. And according to this sine and cosine representation, I can say tan theta is also equal, for all practical purposes, theta for small theta. Okay? So therefore, for small beta L, that is for small lengths compared to lambda over 4, I can write J z naught beta L. Remembering my beta is related to omega over v. I even remember what that v is. That v is 1 over the square root of LC. 1 over the square root of mu epsilon. But that became, in a transmission line, 1 over square root of LC. Okay? Now what about this Z0? That's the characteristic impedance, 50 ohms, we often assume. But what is it in terms of the basic parameters? It's like square root of mu over epsilon, but there is a geometrical factor to think about, okay? Which? Right? So that is my impedance. Am I right here? Did I lose anything? I don't think I lost anything. Now, you multiply these together, J omega L. And that is... Now, where is the geometrical factor coming in? Geometrical factor is hidden inside the definitions of L and C, so I don't have to worry about in this discussion, okay?
Is that just J omega?
Huh? No, I forget about the geometry. It's inverse of one another, but I don't have to worry about them because geometrical factors are in the relationships between mu and L and epsilon and C. We are just working without expanding them, so bear with me here. Okay, this is exactly Z0, and this is exactly, I have beta is omega over V, 1 over V is squared LC, these guys cancel, I have the result what I'm after, Brian, because I ended up with a formula for the impedance. I want you now to announce to the class the main point, which is in the form of...
J omega L.
Yes, that's the point. Okay, and maybe you're saying that. Are you saying that?
No, I'm saying.
Yeah, so L times L, this is length times the inductance per unit length, became RL, okay? Maybe you're saying that.
Yeah.
I would sympathize with you saying that, but these da moments is what, you know, nails down our knowledge and assurance that things are working fine. Okay, so very short, transmission line shorted, isn't it that? Okay, but as its size starts getting comparable to quarter wavelength, it is no longer an inductor, because an inductor is an animal of the lump circuit world. As you are getting close to lambda lambda or lambda over 4, your notions of lumped elements are going away. They are becoming these things that we are learning. Okay, so that's it. Okay, thank you.
I think we were saying the same thing, because it was inductance per unit length.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a length, so
yeah,
it's, like it's just j omega times the inductance.
Exactly, that's what I'm saying. We are saying the same thing. That was my...